Hey, this is Michael. Before we jump in today, the conversation, I think you agree, provides you with invaluable content every other week. And I wanted to let you know that a lot of work goes into making this show, including not only planning and the recording of guests themselves, but also many hours of both vetting and then editing the footage. Plus, this program is almost entirely self-funded. So here's how you can support us. Go to theconversationpod.com/support, and you can donate to the show either via PayPal, Patreon, or Venmo. You can also simply reach out to us individually via theconversationartpodcast@gmail.com, and we will work out a way you can contribute financially. So thank you very much in advance for your support, and now let's get on to the show. This is The Conversation, a podcast that goes behind the scenes between the lines of the contemporary art worlds. Welcome to the show. I am Michael Shaw, and it is episode 253 with Lauren Van Haftenschick. Say that three times fast. She is a writer, curator, an expert on artist contracts, rights, and laws, and currently a PhD candidate in the history of art and visual studies at Cornell. She's splitting her time between Ithaca, where Cornell is, and New York City. And she is a great ambassador for artist rights. She is really on the side of the artist. And it was all inspired by about 10 years ago when she was working at a gallery. And one of the artists who was showing at the time sold a work, or I should say, a work of the artist was sold for $1 million at auction. And the ramifications and complications that came out of that vis-a-vis the artist's reaction, the director of the gallery's reaction, had a real impact on Lauren and definitely had a big impact in shaping her future in artist law, artist rights, and so on. She's particularly an expert on Seth Siegelab's contract, which is called The Artist Reserve Rights Transfer and Sale Agreement from 1971. We don't talk that much about that, just a little bit. She talks about a couple of artists who alter that contract for their own uses, both women artists. But we also just talk a lot about artist rights, the way that Occupy and its effects have affected the way artists look at those issues, artist rights and contracts and so on. I think you'll find it very illuminating and entertaining as well, I hope. The website for this show is theconversationpod.com, where you can see images of Lauren giving a talk and a couple of epic images, not very high quality, honestly, but very impactful, of the infamous collector Robert Scull of taxi cab fortune fame. And Robert Rauschenberg, who essentially confronted both aggressively and also lovingly, perhaps, Scull at that auction. So there's a picture of Rauschenberg shoving Scull, which is from a documentary about that auction. So I highly recommend you check that out, among other things on the website. You check the back catalog and so on. Before we jump in on the back end, we do have some great Weiss links, as always. Without further ado, let us join the conversation with Lauren Van Haftenschick. Thank you very much for being here. I'll talk to you more on the back end.
So what year was it? Maybe this was 2010. It's hard to remember. Something like that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Basically, I had my kind of first, I guess, shock of the secondary market when a young, then quite young, a relatively young artist at the gallery was showing. His works had been selling for, you know, some like 20-something thousand, like, you know, good amounts, not huge, and was kind of starting to get a lot of attention. They must have been more than 20. I don't remember. But one day, a work of his went up for auction, and a bidding war ensued between three collectors, I think. And the work eventually sold for, I think it was over $1 million overnight.
Right.
This astronomical jump in price. And when this happened, and I remember seeing the auction report and turning to the gallery director and thinking, oh, this is great. You know, his prices are, you know, his prices are going to go up, but this also means like, oh, this is going to be good for the gallery. This is a great thing. And the director looked at me and was like, this is terrible. And later in the day, the artist came into the gallery, and at the time he was, you know, I think expecting a kid and had sick parents that he was helping take care of and really needed money, actually. And he came in, I remember he just sort of sat down with us and was just pissed off and also just kind of heartbroken in a way that this insane sale had just happened and he wasn't going to get a dime of it. Now, the other reason why this was a bad thing is that it just sent the market for his work, you know, in a kind of tailspin. I mean, not going down, but just in utter confusion, basically, because what do you do, you know, with an artist whose price point has just jumped that much? Is it actually that high? Well, no, because there was no way you could, you know, that there was going to be that much interest overnight. But it really kind of, you know, set him on a very, very jagged trajectory for a while. He's doing fine now. He's at a very big gallery.
Let me interject for a second.
Yeah.
To what extent do you think it's better to keep this artist's name anonymous in this context so that it would, as if my guess is that by mentioning this artist's name, you feel maybe that would distract from the point that you're trying to, or the sort of phenomena that you're trying to describe? Am I right or am I wrong?
Maybe it's two things. I mean, I don't think it's about an individual,
right?
In a way, I think this is something that happens all the time. Actually,
does it?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think it does. It's about the sort of volatility and the runaway sort of velocity that the secondary market can be capable of, or just the art market in general.
Right.
I mean, we have these kind of, you know, overnight success phenomena things that happen now and, you know, have been going on since the 80s and before, and, you know, but what they do is, as I said, introduce a lot of sort of confusion about sort of where an artist, you know, should be, even in terms of what gallery they should be at, or, you know, how much their work should be sold for, and, you know, on and on and on. But I mean, one thing that we talked about previously, and which I'm also very interested in, is this sort of question of should the artist get a percentage of resale?
Right.
And so, I mean, it was a very telling reaction, you know, that on the one hand, the artist was very angry and just kind of upset in general that he wasn't going to get anything. And yet, there was also already a knowledge that his primary market prices would go up and he would probably be fine, which is to say that sort of within that anecdote, you have sort of that both of like the injustice and the great sort of contradiction, which is that once artists' works do make it into the secondary market, well, generally, not always at all, but in a lot of cases, anyway, it's because their primary market prices are okay or are going to rise. But I want to actually go back to one other sort of maybe formative thing at the time, because this is also the year, you know, I said 2010. Well, that's 1 year before Occupy, and also right still in the throes of the recession. So what was interesting and thinking in this moment is it was this also this kind of burst of activity happening among artists around like thinking about the art economy and maybe how the art economy could kind of be restructured or retooled. I mean, I don't know if you remember, but there were this huge number of projects in this little window of time that were all sort of focused on like free schools and and time banks. And, you know, I remember this phrase, alternative economies started being used. And it was, I was part of a series of workshops by curator Aaron Sickler with that title. And I was a very big part, I really participated in a lot of these things. So it was interesting, and I think it's still interesting historically, that, you know, we kind of had this explosion of activity among artists in those years, thinking about how the art economy could be restructured, retooled.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but at the same time, the art market at the upper end definitely took a dip after the recession, but it was only a few years until it roared back.
Yeah.
And is now, you know, far more powerful than before 2008.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of this confluence of things happening at once, and which I guess is all kind of what led me to what I've been researching now for the past, I don't know what, 6 years, which are sort of artist rights laws, including resale royalties. Artist activism around having rights in their work, and then more specifically, how artists use contracts as a way of kind of securing rights,
mm-hmm.
and just understanding the history of that.
Right.
And resale royalties really, really figures very big in this history, particularly in the context of the U.S., where we've never had a federal resale royalties law, even though it's been proposed many times.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that, but I do want to go back to this example, this
mm-hmm.
sort of really colorful anecdote that you were privy to when you were working at Nicole Klagsbrunn, who was a guest on this show, by the way.
Oh, great.
She's
wonderful.
I was thinking, and I think a lot of artists who are listening and maybe people who are in the art world who aren't even artists might be thinking as well. If I were in that situation, it's first of all, it's hard to imagine for an artist who it hasn't happened to. It's hard to imagine your work selling at auction for $1 million+, right? But if we are to imagine ourselves individually being in that position, I could kind of empathize with a certain amount of frustration, if not maybe just confusion, over the fact that here a work that I made is being sold for $1 million+, and where's my stake in that? You know, I can certainly mm-hmm. see some kind of frustration with that. But the fact that that happened, and even though, as you said, it sent the work into a tailspin, which is not to say up or down, but confusion. Ultimately, mm-hmm. as was proven, this artist's work went up, right? Any artist's work who's selling for low five figures, whose work sells at auction for $1 million, they're, you know, the gallery that's going to have host the next show, the prices are going to go up. So I have a hard time empathizing with the director that you were working with and the artist for their respective frustrations.
Hmm. Well, two things about that, or I'll give you sort of two responses to that.
Sure.
I think on one level, there's a way of framing it, which is just simply, I'm taking this from a New Yorker article a few years ago, but simply it tipped the chef, which is to say that if you think of it is you know, let's stick with the numbers that have been proposed in legislation in the U.S. The number there is 5% of the resale value. So when you're talking about, you know, $1 million painting, I mean, you know, whatever, 5% of that compared to, say, whatever the collector might be making is really pretty paltry.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think there's something to be said for acknowledging not just the fact that the collector is able to benefit so much from a resale. But also just the fact that the artist has, you know, been putting in their time all along to also participate in promoting their work or their career, you know, still participating in the art world, basically contributing to the building of value. They are on a continual basis contributing to the increase in value of their work. And I think there's something to be said for acknowledging that over time. And now that's not to say that collectors shouldn't be able to profit on resale. I think that that's perfectly reasonable to a degree. Because they do, you know, in the end, pay for things like restoration. They pay astronomical amounts for storage. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe they have to hire art handlers, all of this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. These are all, let's think of them as stewardship costs, mm-hmm. right? I mean, I think is a pretty healthy framing of the whole thing, just because, right, steward versus even collector or let's use the word owner. Because it's a way of sort of introducing this entire dynamic as a relationship, and a relationship that's frankly about, I think, care. But nonetheless, I do think, especially in cases too, where, you know, a lot of artists, if they even make it to the point where they're selling work, it's often a long struggle, and they often have to lay out huge amounts of their own money along the way. And I frankly see nothing wrong with an artist getting a share of that in the end, because it's again about recognizing the work that they've been putting in over time to also building that value.
Right.
But there's a really important point about resale royalties that rarely gets discussed, which is the fact that a lot of the work that does sell on the secondary market isn't, going for $1 million. It's maybe going for a few thousand. And in many jurisdictions, artists would get a percentage of those sales too. And those are actually really substantial, because I think it's actually a really important aspect. I cannot stress how much of an important aspect it is to the whole conversation. Because for artists who have not been in the lucky position to end up with a kind of strong, you know, market for their work, but do end up having something sell in the secondary market, say like with a, you know, somebody's estate or something like this, you know, where all of their possessions were auctioned or something like that. If that artist can end up getting $1,000 as a royalty, that's a great thing, because mm-hmm. it's probably someone who didn't become wealthy at all in the first place. Mm-hmm. So that $1,000 actually really means something to them.
Right.
And this is a pretty high amount of artists who do receive resale royalties. I'm regretting not having the UK statistics in front of me right now, but I want to say it's close to like half of the artists who have received resale royalties since their system was introduced in 2006 are actually these small sums, which is to say that a lot of artists are affected by this, not just the wealthy stars. And I think it's very unfortunate that a lot of the time when resale royalties get written about, it's either, you know, they either limit the scope of the data that they're looking at to like Sotheby's and Christie's, the highest end auction houses in the world, or only look at the star cases. So there's this very famous incident, even let's call it that, from 1973. Actually, I think it's like October 18th was the day of the auction. So we can think of this as almost an anniversary.
Right, right. Today's the 17th.
It was close. Anyway, but it's just referred to as the Skull Auction, and it was the auction of the collection of Robert and Ethel Skull, who made their money by being a magnate of a taxi company. Skull was a major collector. I think probably maybe one who, he's not really given as much credit as he should in some ways, but he was a major collector of American art in the 1950s to the early 60s, mostly through the 70s. And in 1973, had a major auction of a lot of works from his collection. And it marked as the first time that contemporary American art was sold at auction in kind of such a brazenly speculative way.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that reputation is due to the astronomical prices that the works sold for. So there's this, the sort of famous incident is after one of Rauschenberg's works, which originally sold for $900, was resold at the auction for $85,000. At the end of the auction, Rauschenberg goes up to Skull and pushes him and you know, says something like you should buy me flowers. And Skull says, well, but your prices will go up now. You know, it works for you too. You know, we work for each other, which is illuminating this contradiction perfectly that we talked about earlier, where, yes, Rauschenberg kind of got gypped on the sale and that he didn't get anything for it. But as we all know, he's a, you know, major name and the works sell for millions now. But the problem with focusing on this anecdote is that Rauschenberg kind of becomes the key example that we have when we talk about resale royalties. And I do think that while the contradictory aspects of that of it are very important, it kind of gives this sort of false image to the history that we're only talking about the Rauschenbergs here.
Right. You know, I don't think it's a coincidence. I don't think it's random that you mentioned 2010, you know, when you were working in galleries, and then 2011, mm-hmm. a year later, was Occupy. And then just a few minutes ago, you were talking about, you know, what rights artists have, and that this mm-hmm. has been the thrust of your study, you know, particularly around Seth Siegelab, who you can talk a little bit about. Maybe he can sort of thread in and out of the conversation. But all that to say, I wonder to what extent, you know, being a scholar now and then going forward in whatever you do, how much your objective is to be an activist in terms of helping the U.S. actually capture this resale royalty agenda.
Well, I think on one level, the more that I learned about it and the more that I've had public events about it with artists and even just sort of one-on-one debates about it with artists and with lawyers, I should say, my feeling on resale royalties has shifted a lot to the point of maybe I'll just say that I'm kind of in the midst of reassessing my own feelings about them. And I can explain that. So in summer 2018, I organized a series of roundtables, a public open roundtable at Pioneer Works in Brooklyn with an artist, Kenneth Petrobono, where we were looking at some of the history and relevance, actually, of different artist rights laws. And we invited, you know, lawyers and artists to come in and sort of begin by sort of sharing their knowledge on an issue. Like we did one on obscenity laws with Svetlana Mincheva of the National Coalition Against Censorship. We did one on moral rights laws with the artists from Five Points. And the third event was on resale royalties. And the art lawyer, Don Zaretsky, joined us in conversation. And where I think I kind of went into that conversation really almost like guns blazing, like this is an important issue that artists need to get behind, and how come we're not all calling our representatives in Congress passing this law?
Mm-hmm.
Don opened up the conversation by posing just a question about like whether this was really the right thing to be advocating for. are resale royalties really the right aim when they are so fraught by this contradiction of largely benefiting artists who are already wealthy?
Mm.
Like, why were we, you know, the people in the room,
mm-hmm.
none of whom were wealthy artists,
right.
you know, ready to get up in arms around this issue that, you know, maybe wasn't really helping us? And so I never really thought about it in that way before. And I was shocked, actually, at the way in which everybody in the room seemed to kind of be questioning their assumptions very quickly. And the amazing thing about where the conversation went that day, and it was, I just want to say, it was huge, too. Like, of doing all these events and doing other public events on resale royalties, I am consistently shocked at how well attended they are. This is a topic that artists do want to talk about, and we don't talk about it enough.
Mm-hmm.
But where the conversation went over the course of the night was towards a much bigger question around not just resale royalties or not just royalties, but actually redistribution, in the sense of how is it or why is it that our conception of the royalty gets kind of limited at how it can benefit individual artists, to the effect that I don't know that we really have very many working frameworks or examples of things that we could even point to that are about group benefit or collective benefit.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what that would look like. But I think it's a much deeper question, and perhaps even a more relevant way of thinking about the issue right now, when we are in this bizarre moment of, you know, the ultra, ultra high net, the ultra rich asking for a wealth tax. You know, we are in this bizarre moment of, like, Agnes Gunn, you know, or who is it? Like, whatever, these people kind of putting out public statements saying, I have too much money. Take it from me and do something better with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's sort of a bigger set of questions in the air, or that maybe just the stakes have changed. And so in terms of activism, I would still be very happy to see a resale royalties law. I think especially seeing how effective it's been in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm also of the mind that we're not still not asking the right questions.
Mm.
And that maybe they're especially given this condition where the vast disparity in wealth, you know, kind of in the economy at large, is so obvious in the art market right now.
Mm-hmm.
Redistributing that
wealth
is maybe really the question that we need to be asking.
Right.
And because it's so visible in the art market, is why I think the art market is such a fascinating place to be asking that question.
What are some strategies that we can apply that have to do with redistribution in the art world, not unlike redistribution generally in the economy, which is, you know, both being pipe dreams at the moment?
You know, one area that I've been following a bit in the last few years is this sort of intersection of art and blockchain, and the way in which the art world is kind of keeps, or the art market keeps being seen as like kind of like a test case for these technologies.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
there are a number of smart contracts for artists that have been developed.
I'm sorry, say that again. You were crackling up a little bit. A number of what contracts?
Smart contracts.
That's what I thought. Okay. Uh huh.
Yeah. So a smart contract basically being like, it's a digital, you know, agreement that you can think about as sort of being integrated, you know, with the object that is affected by it. And
right.
mm-hmm. any kind of any terms of the agreement that are kind of set out, you know, from the start, get executed automatically
mm-hmm.
throughout the life of the object. So let me give you a clearer example. If you were to sell like a digital artwork using a smart contract that would give you, the artist, a royalty anytime the work was, say, like displayed, or royalty when it was resold. Those payments would go to you automatically. Mm-hmm. There wouldn't be this, you know, resistance. Resistance would be futile. But there wouldn't be. Again, the models that have been sort of presented so far are still stuck at this idea of the individual artist being the one to get the royalty. But I wonder if there are ways that we could think about value kind of being collected from, I mean, it sounds like a pipe dream, I know, but what if there was a way to like collect, you know, a little percentage of value, you know, kind of off of all of the works that sell over a certain amount, and to pool that value together towards some kind of bigger purpose. Mm-hmm. I don't know what that would be. I don't, you know, a similar thing to this was actually proposed in a version of federal resale royalties legislation from 2011, where the way that it was structured was that a small percentage of resales would have actually gone into a pool of money designated for museums to purchase the work of living American artists. I don't think it's a perfect solution, and I don't know what one would be, but it's just saying, I think we need to be asking or considering frameworks that go beyond individual rights, individual gain, individual profit, I guess, and really think about how we can capture the huge amount of value that the art market is capable mm-hmm. of producing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And use it differently.
Sure.
So
you're talking about the socialism or socialization of the art world or art market, which
I guess
is a pretty tough sell. Yeah, yeah.
But I know, but there are many examples. Like for example, at one point, Rauschenberg, he actually did say at one point that he wanted a percentage of collectors' profits on resale to be donated to his nonprofit called Change Inc., which was set up to give grants for artists with medical expenses.
Mm.
Or like Neri Ward had a piece in his recent New Museum retrospective where the resale profits were to be donated to the Bowery Mission.
Mm.
I think the entire piece is designed as a fundraiser. But so like even like initial like proceeds from the initial purchase go towards the Bowery Mission, but so do resale profits,
mm-hmm.
which is fascinating.
Well, that brings up the ideal that even though, you know, to go back to what we're talking about with the lawyer's point, you know, do we really want to do this lobby for this resale when most of it's going to the, you know, the big boy or the big name artist or the big market artist? Isn't as much as you and others working in this direction would like to bring about change kind of from the middle, if you will, it seems that to use your example of Neri Ward in the museum, but other artists who have probably had some inroads in this regard as well. It seems like big artists who have all this money and relative power would be fantastic role models or activists themselves, or you know, have so much leverage in setting the tone of redistribution.
Yeah, well, I mean, Rauschenberg was instrumental in getting the California Resale Royalties Act passed in 1976,
mm-hmm.
and really was a humongous advocate for artist rights laws in general and beyond that. But yeah, I do think it is the, let's say, responsibility even mm-hmm. of those who have more power in the field, who are more visible in the field, to also help in putting forth models of how it could be shaped and behave otherwise. Mm-hmm. I mean, that sounds like a great idea. I don't know if that's like it seems like another pipe dream.
Sure, it does.
But one thing that's interesting to me, I guess, about looking into this historically is that, you know, I read, you know, the congressional hearings around resale royalties laws from, you know, the 80s and the early 90s. And, like, Robert Mangold is there. Jenny Holzer is there. Hans Hacke is there. Like, these mm-hmm. big names are on the record giving testimony in favor of these laws getting passed. Like, they showed up.
Right.
And that is a big generational difference, I guess, that I see now. Because mm-hmm. I've also, of course, followed the, you know, Copyright Office roundtables around resale royalties that have been held more recently. And I don't see artists participating. Frank Stella participated, mm-hmm. but, you know, he's of that older generation. I think it's very curious, actually, that my generation, the generation above mine, isn't vocal or participating in the same way.
Let's go away from the high end and go back to the mm-hmm. middle or the lower end, because you were mentioning the UK model, how that was successful. And you were also mentioning how you'd seen, you know, bits of income or royalties going on a much smaller scale. And I was trying mm-hmm. to sort of picture what that would look like, because to make it into a Sotheby's, Christie's, what have you, Phillips type level auction, you know, you have to generally be a pretty big name to begin with, even if you're a younger artist. And so I was imagining what it would look like if an artist, something on such a modest scale that, like, an artist donated a work to, you know, a moderately high profile fundraiser type thing, you know, and, mm-hmm. You know, and it was a bidding type situation. And so somebody bought a given artist's work for, I don't know, $3,000, let's say. You know, what are your thoughts about what should an artist get? I mean, because it's a donation, it's probably a very different context. But I mean, if an artist isn't going to get any resale from a situation like that, is it going to be that kind of scale, you know, in a more traditional auction situation?
Mm-hmm. Well, two things to that. I mean, there's a Sotheby's and Christie's and Phillips are the top tier, but there are so many lower tier auction houses that so often get completely left out of this conversation, which is to say that the works that sell through those auction houses,
but
like
how many really are there?
Photography, I mean, or heritage.
I'm just asking. Yeah, how many are there really? Because I mean, I'm in Los Angeles. There's an auction house here called Butterfield, I believe it is. That's the only auction house I can think of other than the big names in this whole city.
Los Angeles, I don't know as much. I am a through and through New Yorker.
Sure. But, how many are there in New York?
I couldn't even tell you, because I think there's a lot that I don't even know. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But even beyond that, we're not just talking about Los Angeles. We're not just talking about Los Angeles and New York City. I mean, there are auction houses in smaller cities that do things more like dealing with estates. Like, they're not specialized, art and antique places, or not even specialized in high-end sales. They're kind of much more varied in the kinds of material that goes through them. But it is a mess. I think there's a the way that you're pointing to this sort of lack of clarity around just how big this sector of the market really is, I think is notable, mm-hmm. because it's not only something that gets lost in the conversation, but I think there's really lacking research on the scope of the art resale market among these kind of smaller level auctions. That's research that I would love to help with in the future. I think I need a real data person to work on it. But I think it's really important. And frankly, I've really struggled to find good research that actually accounts for all of that.
Mm-hmm.
But just, you know, knowing what we know about the numbers that we do have. So, for example, I just pulled up one of the reports from the UK, the UK organization that collects artist resale royalties. DAX is the acronym for it. And one of their statistics is that, or one of their data points is that the total recovered royalty payments made to individual artists and estates in 2015 ranged from £30 to £90,000.
Wow.
So they were paying out royalties that were £30.
Mm-hmm.
which is to say that there is apparently a secondary market for works where that's the royalty.
I wonder how you would most like to sort of spend the rest of our conversation. I mean, do you want to talk about maybe some of the biggest takeaways from your dissertation research, or do you want to talk more specifically about the artist reserve rights transfer and sale agreement? I mean, maybe if you do choose that, talk about it in the context of, you know, what's going on now, because we did talk about that a lot at the beginning. But it's up to you. What's your preference?
I think talking about the contract kind of makes the most sense.
Sure.
Because it is at the heart of these conversations.
Yeah. Actually, let me just quote from your article referring to the agreement, which was the way that the contract was referred to from an artist perspective. The agreement was developed to be the standard contract used when artwork was sold or title transferred. Its more extreme provisions grant the artist a veto right over the exhibition of their sold works, a percentage of any fee a collector may receive from lending the work, and 15% of the work's accrued value at resale.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that last clause is really, well, really the key in a big way. I think the veto right is really major also. It does different things, but the 15% is this like funny little artifact that has been reproduced in other artist contracts that are kind of modeled on the Siegelab one, or are modeled on this one, or that predate it, and is just so famous that even offhand among art lawyers, for example, it'll get referred to as, you know, the Prjansky clause. And I say Prjansky and I said Siegelab earlier because the co-authors of the contract were Seth Siegelab, who's best known as a kind of curator, dealer, really a publisher of conceptual art exhibitions in the late 1960s. He actually really kind of leaves the art world in 1971. And a lawyer, Robert Prjansky,
mm-hmm.
who did actually work with a lot of artists in these years, the late 60s, early 1970s, to advocate for everything from, you know, artist gallery relations to actually housing rights and things like this. So it's sort of the Siegelab-Prjansky agreement to lawyers, the Prjansky agreement to most artists. It's known as the artist contract.
Mm.
And it's really this kind of iconic document, not only of its time. It was written in 1970 to 1971, and is really kind of like an emblem of the extraordinary sort of energy of artist activism at the time, but also these questions that were kind of being raised by artists at the time, specifically those which get associated with conceptual art, who are really raising major challenges to not only the notion of the work of art as a static object or traditional art object like a painting or sculpture, but more so sort of raising challenges to the ways in which art could be owned and experimenting through things like very unusual certificates of authenticity or other kinds of contracts, experimenting with ways in which they could retain some kind of ownership in the work, or at the very least, sort of establish what would really be an ongoing relationship between the artist and the collector, mm-hmm. instead of just the kind of one-off sale sort of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so what the artist contract, the agreement does, is that it's, or the way it's designed to be used, is that it's signed between the artist and the collector at the first sale. And that's when, you know, ostensibly all of the terms that are just in the agreement as a standard form are, you know, agreed upon by both parties, although it can be modified as artists want. And then when the work is resold, it gets signed by collector one and collector two. And then, you know, it resold again, collector two and collector three. So while any lawyer would raise their eyebrows now and say, oh, well, that raises massive problems of enforceability,
mm-hmm.
it also mm-hmm. raises this sort of different notion about, I think anyways, like collectors sort of enforcing among themselves both the idea that the artist's rights as they were set out in the contract should be kind of respected over time and on an ongoing basis, and that there's, you know, kind of a way in which collectors have to keep each other accountable and make each other sort of adhere to this very, very different notion of what a transaction, a sale in art looks like.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, the contract itself was reproduced in tons of art magazines in 1971 and through the early 1970s. It was also written about in many, many law books to this day. Actually, virtually any legal text, like a law journal article, for example, that talks about resale royalties references the Siegel Lobb Agreement. It's even discussed in Copyright Office reports mm-hmm. on resale royalties legislation.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also been circulated among many different circles of artist activists, too. So this is, you know, circling back to the post-recession and Occupy moment. These were the years where, I mean, I became aware of it because I saw it being referenced by activists who were interested in this question about how can we rethink how the art market operates in ways that will make it more equitable? And so in the last 10 years, the sort of iconicity of the contract has, I think, really just heightened in a very interesting way where, you know, just as we're talking about, you know, what do resale royalties mean now versus, you know, in the 1970s, for example, we also get to talk about what do the terms in the agreement mean now versus what they did in the 1970s.
Mm. What do you think? Yeah. I mean, just bottom line, what do you think? You do mention that it's being taken up by activists, you know, out of Occupy and, you know, and those various permutations. But what do you see its legacy as bottom line now? I mean, obviously it was incredibly ambitious towards artist control, but, you know,
mm-hmm.
meanwhile we're still living in this, you know, very collector friendly moment or environment. So, you know, do you see it sort of taking on this very sort of underground distribution, you know, that gets into activist hands and that kind of thing, essentially?
Well, I think that was sort of its aim, and it does operate like that, I think. I mean, it really, I'm using the very heavy word of icon, you know,
yeah.
for good reason, I
right.
think, it really is an emblem of this sort of idea of, again, how we could do business otherwise. And in that sense, I think as it circulates, it's been more powerful. I almost like bite my tongue every time I say this, but I think that it's true. The fact that it's been so powerful as a symbol versus as a legal document in terms of its use as a legal document is actually very significant.
Mm.
Because, and I say this because it gets written about a lot as if it was a total failure because it never became the standard. Some critics say that all it did was just assert, the artwork as a commodity, it's so kind of cumbersome to use that it was, never going to work as a contract from the beginning. Well, for one thing, over the course of my research, I've been shocked, actually, at the number of artists who I've had the real honor of meeting who have used the agreement or have made interesting modifications of it that they have also used, which is to say that it has a much bigger life than it's been, I think, than has actually been accounted for so far. But why I say it's really important as a symbol is because it does in the end serve as this kind of model or a starting point, perhaps, for the kinds of not just rights that we could ask, or that artists can ask for in their work, but also a model for how we could rethink what kinds of relationships we have to the people who collect our work, own our work, promote our work, and the fact that we're actually kind of entangled together in a way. Like, in a nice way, it emphasizes the fact that artists and collectors and dealers and really everyone in this whole, messy pot are very entangled.
So what's an artist example of an artist who's actually used this contract, and, what would be the kind of circumstance in which they would actually be able to use it?
Well, I'll give you two.
Okay.
So Jackie Windsor used a slightly modified version of it. It's just kind of reduced in its language. Through most of the 1970s, she was showing with Paula Cooper Gallery, so had, the backing of a very powerful, very respected dealer. But a lot of her reason for using it was that she felt at the time that her work wasn't given the kind of care and respect of a lot of her male counterparts. And in a way, she saw using the contract as a way of asserting that her work was actually deserving of the kind of treatment that, something very high priced would get, even though because it was sold for a relatively low price at the time, collectors maybe wouldn't have assumed that it was as precious as she thought it was.
Mm.
And when I spoke to her, I started by one of the first things I asked her, this seems to resonate really strongly with a lot of the impulses behind the women's movement. And her first response was just, yes, of course, in a really fascinating way that I'd never heard before,
mm-hmm.
which is that, because we don't think about, when we think about the activism around the women's movement, we don't think about, things like sales contracts, one, because women weren't really selling work at the time. But instead, for Windsor and for other women artists of that generation that I've since very happily learned about, the contract really was both a practical tool, but also a symbol of kind of asserting that their work was of equal value and deserving of equal treatment of, again, their male counterparts.
Hmm.
I'll give you a more a current example.
Right.
There's a wonderful young artist in New York named Alex Strada, who has made also a modified version of the 1971 contract, where she has retooled the resale royalty so that collectors have to sell a work after 10 years.
Oh, wow.
And when they sell the work after 10 years, they need to put any profit into buying the work of another emerging female artist.
Mm-hmm.
So there, here we begin to see this one version of this redistributive capacity that's also recognizing frankly, a persistent gender disparity in the art market. Mm. And maybe I went to those two examples because I think they do a really beautiful job of illuminating how, well, on one level, something as sort of dry as a sales contract can actually be used. I mean, they actually both have sold work using these agreements, but also how the symbolic meaning that it carries with the agreements can resonate in so many different ways. And in different ways over time, too.
Hmm. Great.
Yeah.
Well, Lauren Van Haftenschick, it's great to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been fun. I feel like we could keep going.
We could easily keep going another hour, but alas. Yeah. And we're out. Once again, many thanks to Lauren Van Haftenschick for being such a great guest and such a generous guest. You may have noticed in spirit how generous she is in personality, but even off mic, she has been very generous as well, and I'm very grateful for that. Love having guests like that. And if you want to go check her out, see what she's up to, because you're intrigued about the various projects and rights that she's protecting and attempting to protect and enlighten us about, just go to laurenvhs.com. All right, before we get to the old news, I do want to let you know this is a listener-supported show. Thank you very much to those of you who are ongoing supporters, mainly via Patreon, a couple via PayPal, and a couple via more direct and mysterious means. Thank you very much for keeping the show going. If you would like to support the show financially, as I mentioned at the top, you can go to theconversationpod.com/support. And all your potential ways, or you can just contact us directly for other ways of supporting the show. And if you want to support the show non-financially, you can let people know about it. Spreading the word is always very appreciated, especially to people who do not know about us and you think would appreciate listening to us. You can also leave a great review, 5-star great review on Apple Podcasts or wherever else you might listen. And you can follow us at Artist Podcast on Instagram or Twitter. And we have a Facebook page as well, if you want to follow us there. So thank you in advance. Big thanks, as always, to producer Andy Davis for helping sculpt this episode so beautifully, and to newer producer Amanda Roth, who is helping with the guest queue. Thank you so much to you both. Now, let's get on to the old news, a.k.a. the Weiss Links. From Gothamist, Charging Bull's injured horn is finally being mended. Repairs to the Charging Bull statue in Lower Manhattan began Wednesday following damages sustained last month by a man who repeatedly smashed the bull's horn with a metal banjo. Tevin Varlak, 42, from Dallas, used what appeared to be a metal banjo to attack the bull while cursing President Donald Trump. He was arrested and charged with criminal mischief and disorderly conduct. Decolonize these documents. Warren Kanders may have caved to pressure to step down from the board of the Whitney Museum after artists in its biennial rose up to protest his ownership of a weapons company that makes tear gas used on immigrants at the southern U.S. border, but the billionaire hasn't given up on the fight. Attorneys for Kanders have reached out to lawyers for New York University to place a legal hold on all documents held by Professor Amin Hussein, the activist scholar and a leader of Decolonize This Place, the group that pushed hardest for Kanders' ouster. The hold will prevent Hussein and the university from deleting documents or emails in case Kanders and his company, Safariland, want to take legal action against Decolonize. And finally, this is from Martin Airbear via tweet. Disgusted to read that scientists have been to the deepest depths of the ocean and found, even there, a biennale. All right, that's enough biennales for this episode. Thank you so much again for listening and for your support. And I will talk to you again in a couple of weeks. Until then, ciao for now.